Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that gives us an opportunity to meet people who make a difference in our communities and in our lives. I'm Bob Willard, and I will be your host as we visit today with Martina Arroyo. For the next hour or so, we'll ask her a few questions, play some music, and meet the person behind the persona. Martina, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Bob.
Now, Martina, let me introduce you to our listeners by mentioning some of your accomplishments. Martina Arroyo, Distinguished Professor of Music at Indiana University, has performed in the most prestigious opera houses in the world. The Met, the Paris Opera, La Scala, Covent Garden, Vienna State Opera, if I missed any.
Yes, a few. Buenos Aires, Teatro Colón. You said Vienna, all of the German houses, Munich, from Hamburg down to Munich, and higher and lower.
Okay, we're talking about every major opera house in the world. She has performed with great conductors of the world, including over 50 recordings with such conductors as Leonard Bernstein, Raphael Kubelik, Riccardo Muti, Claudio Abbado, James Levine, Thomas Schippers. She's been a frequent guest on The Tonight Show, and she's often heard on the Singers' Roundtable at the Met. She's an honorary trustee of Carnegie Hall, has been a member of the National Endowment of the Arts, and recently was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Well, that's just for starters. Let's simplify the introduction and say Martina Arroyo is one of the great ones.
Oh, aren't you nice? Thank you.
Well, I mean that. Okay. Now, let's get into some questions here.
Okay.
Performing as a recitalist, as a concert performer, or on the operatic stage all require different preparation. How do you discipline yourself to be at your peak for each performance?
Well, you're not always at your peak, really. I think that I've sung some of my best performances in the bathroom or at the rehearsal hall. You never really feel that this is a defined performance that cannot be better. You're always, how do you judge that? You just try to be at your peak for that day under those circumstances. If you've traveled from the United States to Europe and you have to sing the next day, which is already silly, but to stay in shape, you need to make sure that you get as much rest as you can, that you eat properly. Properly means a different thing to different people. For me, I like pasta and all the wrong things, as you can tell by my figure. Always rehearsing. And again, I'm saying this because I'm hoping that there'll be some students who will be listening and who will believe that I did, but there were many times I didn't and I paid for it. You know, that's a part of, also a part of being a professional. Always being aware of what your characters are and who they are and what you want to say about them, which means constant study, really. How do you stay in peak shape? I think mentally it's important to stay in peak shape, meaning health, to live healthily, think as healthily as you can. I have a great support system around me. My family was very supportive all of these years. My husband is probably the only man who can put up with me for too long. And then, of course, your musical family, your voice teacher, your coach, your pianist, the person who coaches with you on a regular and rehearses with you on a regular basis, these people who know you better than anyone else, the people for whom you don't put on a professional persona, the people who see you at your worst and who still help you through the times to get so that you can stay, in the public's opinion, in peak shape. It's a little bit difficult to try to say that there's a schedule that I followed, even though I know singers who do say that they do certain things every single day, but I'm not one of them. Unfortunately, I enjoy also taking time off for the extra movie, or I love to go out dancing. I used to love to go out dancing. I like living. I enjoy that part of life, which sort of refills my soul so that I can go out and perform.
But isn't sometimes that living of the life what prepares you, particularly to do a leader recital or something, so you understand the lyrics?
Bob, for me, text is almost more important than singing. And I'm saying that, and I know you're probably going to say, what is this woman saying? To have a beautiful voice is something you are given as a great gift by God, in my opinion. And you develop it. You do the work with your teachers to keep it in the best shape. But the most beautiful sound in the world, unless it's saying something, unless it's giving a message to the people that are listening, you might as well then not be singing. You might as well be speaking. You apply that voice that you have to the text, to giving it the color, your spiritual sharing, all of that, but through the text, as the composer has given it to you, and as along with the accompaniment. Because you see, it's not just your voice, it's you and the piano, or you and the orchestra, or you and your colleagues, the entity, whether it's on the concert stage, the recital stage, or on the opera performance stage. You put this together, you're a component of the whole. And to do your share, to stay into the best gear for it, meaning knowing exactly what you want to say and how you want to say it, and trying to say it at its best all the time, that's my job.
Well, does it make it difficult if you are working with an accompanist, either as an orchestra conductor or a pianist, who has a different opinion of how that text should go? How do you handle that?
Well, through rehearsals, because the performance day is not the day to start the argument. In my opinion, I have to always say in my opinion, because not everyone approaches these things the same way. I know artists who say to the pianist, you follow me and you are accompanying me. And I don't like the word accompanist, because I think that, again, there's that whole, that ensemble work that gives the audience the whole. If you have a pianist that does not agree with you, and the two of you don't work it out, if it's a song, a lead of some sort, and you don't work it out and bring those colors together for the audience to receive the picture as you're painting it together, you're doing a disservice to the audience, and you're doing an even greater disservice to the music. You can have different opinions, but you can also, in rehearsal, work it out, find out why one thinks that way. And you'll be surprised how much you can learn by listening to somebody else, rather than thinking my way or my way of thinking is the only way.
You've worked with some of these great conductors that we named earlier on. Just what did you learn from them, and what did they bring to your performances that you have taken away?
Just what you said, their viewpoint, their life's experiences, their experiences with other singers from whom they've also taken things, and other performers. Let's not say singers, because they could be any of the forms, disciplines. Sometimes they open a door for you that will allow you to see it, to see a text totally, completely differently. It's amazing how much one small change can allow you to change your whole viewpoint. One of the examples that I like to use is in Ballo in Maschera. There's the moment when Renato, when the veil, Amelia's veil, comes off, and Renato sees that his wife Amelia, in front of all of the courtiers and the men, against his best friend, the king, and he realizes the woman that he's shielding, thinking it's a lover of the king, it turns out to be his wife. Most of the time, 90% of the times in my life that I've done this role, and I really have done lots of ballos, the baritone will push me away and reject me as Amelia. Cheryl Milnes, an old friend, did something else. He pulled me to him, and then he pushed me away. And I was sort of off balance at first, because I said, why you pulled me to you? He said, because regardless, you're my wife, and my first reaction is to protect you. And then realize what the person I'm protecting has also betrayed me. And I must tell you that each time that he pulled me to him and then pushed me away, I saw his face go black. You know, you saw the anger and the his own betrayal in his face. And I knew that in the next scene, this man was really going to kill me, that I was really singing Moreau for my life. You know, of course, always in the context of the play, but that one, I've never worked that particular part in an opera with another baritone that gave me that complete feeling of being in agreement with someone else's idea, and it never occurred to me at all. It wouldn't have occurred to me, but he made it a part of my life, and I'll never forget it.
Well, one of the questions I was going to ask later, and I think maybe we've just worked towards it, is who are the people who have been influential in the in your career and in your learning? Who were your mentors, I guess? I mean, you've mentioned Thomas Shippers, and I could talk all evening just about that man who died way too young.
Too young and too not given nearly the recognition that I think, and I think you believe he deserved. He was a wonderful conductor and a great contribution to the world of opera and symphony. He was just a great teacher. And by the way, he was also a fabulous organist. I went into one of the rooms in Vienna, in the Singverein, I believe, and I heard this organ being played, and I had to stop. I thought, my God, who is that? And it was Thomas Shippers having fun at the organ. I didn't believe it. Anyway, who are my mentors? First of all, my family. My parents were my total supporters. They... Even though their attitude was, okay, if you want to do this thing, go into show business, we'll help you, but you have to have another career. So I promised to work at the profession I really wanted as a young girl anyway, and that was to be a teacher. I've always wanted to be a teacher. But I wanted to teach literature and comparative literature and languages. Again, going back to text, I really do love text. They said, okay, we'll support as much as we can. And they did, with every extra penny, every extra bit of love. I couldn't ask for more from a family, including cousins and sisters and the cousins and the aunts. I really had a great life. Then I went to Hunter College High School in New York, which is a private high school. And the opera workshop from Hunter College used to meet in our high school auditorium. And I think everybody knows the story. You know, young people, when they are together, can be very bold. And we were standing outside of the auditorium listening to this singing, which was, for us, just yelling. So we started wailing, imitating these people. And I got caught, along with my few friends, and we were dragged into Professor Tornell. But, you know, you're not only bold when you're 13 and 14. You're arrogant. You think you can do it, you know? And what I needed was a good swift kick, which I did get, as a matter of fact, many times in life. As a punishment, he said, well, if you all can do it, let's hear you sing. And I sang for him. And instead of, well, he did reprimand me for being foolish, but he also sent me to Marinka Gurevich, who was my one and only voice teacher for more than 30 years, and who... was, again, another leg in my life, a supporter of my professional family. And she sent me to Martin Rich, who coached me all these many years and who recently died in New York City for more than 35 years. Professor Tournau, the man who started me in opera at 14 and a half in the opera workshop, he gave me a scholarship to the opera workshop. Dr. Schuster gave me a scholarship to the college and started my whole road to a musical life. And it was at first a hobby and lots of fun and a brand new thing. I mean, there weren't too many girls on 111th Street and St. Nicholas Avenue who knew about opera, and certainly not many who wanted to be an opera singer. I mean, at that time, astronaut and opera singers were just not your choices. You know, it was Dr. Lawyer or Indian Chief. I did go for Indian Chief, but... That's another story.
That's
another
a different
show.
Opera, too. Yeah,
right. Okay. And... I found myself living more during the hours that I attended the workshop from 4 to 8 o'clock every day than during my college hours, because I was graduated from the high school the next semester and started going to Hunter College. And that's how it all started. And that support system, Dr. Gurevich, Mrs. Gurevich, Dr. Tournau, Martin Rich, my family, my parents, started the whole thing, allowing me to have a life that has been really a great one, a wonderful one.
I want to go back to this. You were wailing out in the hallway, making lots of noise.
Listen, I thought I was singing, but that's all right. You can call it wailing if you like.
Okay.
We were imitating the singers,
all right.
Yes.
And then he pulled you in.
Three or four of us were pulled in by the guidance counselor as a reprimand, and we had to sing for him.
What did you sing?
The Jewel Song from Faust, which I learned from a recording, and he said... That was very nice, my dear, with his cigarette. And he held his cigarette in that old way that Europeans hold it, with the hands turned the other way. He said, what language was that? And, you know, until today, my French stinks. I tell you.
You weren't Lily Pons.
Well, my husband, who is French, says things to me like, did you sing French? Or, her French is good. You didn't teach her, did you? You know, oh, well.
But how did you know that aria at 13 or 14?
Because I had heard, we had records at home. And we also had Dorothy Kirsten singing Un Bel Dia. My parents weren't great opera fans, but they took me to the museums. They brought opera recordings at home. These are records now, not CDs.
78, you know, right.
I'm talking about 70, right. Yeah. And there were household names like Dorothy Kirsten, like Marian Anderson. These were people that they were my contact with classical music, but it was not a serious connection. It was my parents exposing me as much as they could to everything that they didn't have.
Okay, but they were aware of the importance of that kind of music and saw to it that it was available even if you didn't choose to do it.
Yes, and this is important. This is important in the young person's life that all of these forms are exposed to them, not just rap or the going music on the popular station. My parents took me to the ballet. We had the circus. We had the rodeo. We had children's entertainment. And my parents had to work very hard to save the money to get tickets to take me to these. They were annual things. It wasn't something that we could afford to do on a regular basis. But they certainly did see to it that I saw the Nutcracker Suite. Now, you notice I'm mixing Nutcracker Suite with Radio City Music Hall because they were, for them, everything was trying to get us, the young people in the family, out in the world to live a better life than they had. And sometimes all of this sounds so corny, but this was it. If you want to know the story, that was the way it was.
Well, we talked about support group a moment ago, and it sounds to me like your parents were a support group.
Absolutely. Not knowing a thing about opera. My father was so disappointed when he heard the translation to Boheme. He said, and when he saw Aida, he said, why does he want that fat girl when he can have the skinny one over there, the pretty skinny one? They had no indication. And for them, I was going into show business. I think that they finally realized I was not going to kick my legs up and do a can-can dance. You know, it took time. And when my mother, after my father's death, when I was only 20 years old, my mother started traveling with me. And she became, she just went to every performance, whether it was because I was singing, but most of the time it was because people she loved were singing. She had gotten to know Plácido well, Plácido Domingo, and Cheryl Mills, who were my favorite colleagues early on, because we were regularly grouped together. She got to know Ruggero Raimondi, and they came to the house on a regular basis. They became like her children, so she would go, Grace Bunbury, who was one of the winners at the Met in 58 or 59. So she would go to hear them. When she went to hear James King, she said she was going to buy tickets for Max the Singer. And we said, no, Mom, it's Die Meistersinger. You know, but she was going to hear Jim sing Max. And when he came to the house with his wife, he told her he was performing in this opera. She went. She had never seen a Wagner opera in her life.
That's astounding. I mean, what was she like as an audience?
She probably slept through a lot of it. I know she missed me the first night of Don Carlo because she went to the bathroom. And she constantly, you know, you had to give her candy or else she wasn't going to stay. She went to see my first Lohengrin with James King. Oh, maybe he wasn't in the first one. I think maybe Shandor Konya was in the first one. It was a Wieland Wagner production, so there was a bare stage, and, you know, and we had to envision our lives in front of us, like looking in a mirror. And my mother kept looking in the back of the audience to see what we were looking at. Finally, they got her some Cracker Jacks or something from Louis Sherry to keep her quiet. And she was sitting there making comments like, what the heck is that? And Larry Wasserman said, that's the bed, Mrs. Arroyo. She said, some bed. I mean, she just didn't like this production at all. So came the next performance. I said, are you coming? And she said, well, my bursitis is a little bad. And she grabbed her left arm. And I came home. I said, how's your bursitis? And she said, oh, much better. She grabbed her right arm, you know.
So, it's traveling bursitis.
It's traveling bursitis. But only to say that this was not a sophisticated family with a great basis in opera and classical music. But when they became a part of my life, they really partook.
Well, why don't we hear some of the singing that you did?
Sure.
And you've mentioned, you know, Cheryl Mills and Placido Domingo and James King and so forth. Do you have any duets or anything that we could hear with some of these people?
Oh, certainly. As a matter of fact, with both, if you like. There's the duet from Ballo, Ballo in Maschera, with Placido. That's one of my favorite duets, even though my mother always plays Leontine's recording of it.
Oh, no.
But before, remember you mentioned Thomas Shippers just now. Before the big parts at the Met started happening, I was singing very small roles, left the Met and went to Europe and came back and sang bigger roles in 65. But Thomas Shippers had given me a chance, along with Samuel Barber, to premiere the Andromache's Farewell with the New York Philharmonic. That was in 63. Recently, in Oregon, in Eugene, Oregon, John Browning and I were doing their first festival of American music. And the gentleman came out and said, "Oh, how happy we are to have the two original artists that perform these works, chosen by Samuel Barber themselves. And we have the recording, blah, blah." And he went on and on and on. Finally, he said, 35 years ago. Well, if ever anybody beat me in the stomach, it was at that moment. I turned to John and I said, "It couldn't have been. It couldn't have been." And he said, "Oh, yes, honey, it was 35 years ago." So that happened long before the big career in opera began in America. And so I have a great debt to Tom Shippers and Barber and people like Leonard Bernstein, Friedrich Wallman for oratorio performances, for song recitals, long before the big opera career started.
Well, I still want to hear you do a duet with Placido Domingo.
I don't think you have any choice.
Okay, let's do it. We have just heard a recording of The Masked Ball by Verdi with Martina Arroyo, Placido Domingo, in a London recording made with Ricardo Muti as the conductor. Now, Martina, can you explain to us what was going on in that scene?
Certainly. In this scene, Ricardo, or Gustavo, the king, has come onto the scene surprising Amelia because she has come to this graveyard to find the herb that will help her lose her affection for the king. There she is surprised by the very man she not only wants to stop loving, but certainly doesn't want to meet in this moment. And he asks her to declare her love for him as he declares his love for her. And finally, in the end, she gives in, and they, even though they realize that they feel a great deal for each other, Amelia also has asked him to remember that she is married to the man who is his friend and who would give anything. Amelia tries not to give in to this love that she has for the king, and she keeps recalling that she's a married woman and that her husband is his friend, and the conflict goes on back and forth until at the end the culmination is that they do love each other, and it's one of the most glorious duets in all of operatic repertoire, and I loved singing it very, very often with Placido and other tenors, including Pavarotti and some other wonderful, wonderful tenors that have sung this role.
Would your mother come to the performance if Placido Domingo was singing it?
Only if Placido Domingo were singing it. Her attitude when I sang was, "Who else is singing? You know, oh, Placido, oh yeah, I'll come." And that's really a true story.
You gave up, or maybe this was the next step in your life, being a performer to being a teacher. What was it about having the opportunity to work with young people that brought you to Indiana University?
Well, I don't consider it giving up.
Okay.
It's not a step down or giving up something. I still do some singing, and I still enjoy singing. It's the love of my life, so to speak. But after you've sung 35 years, you are no longer the young girl that your heart tells you you are, you know, physically. You're tired sometimes more readily, and you're. But I don't think that was it as much as I've always been attracted to teaching and to working with young people who were obviously going to take all of our places, because that's the cycle. I took someone else's place in some way, and someone has taken my place, and then that person will be replaced. The cycle just goes on. It's only right. And it's not a terrible thing. I know that there are the few artists who think, what is this world going to be without me? But the world's going to be fine. There are many talented people out there, and I just like being a part of their development and contributing, hoping that they're learning from my mistakes, even though I think you always in life have to make your own mistakes, that is. But you certainly still want to contribute and try to make it just a little bit easier. I there's another component. The young people nowadays have to get out there, and I see them at dress rehearsals and premieres with the TV cameras, crowded houses. It's almost a performance, with the recording companies taking in every word they say. I think that if I were making my debut at Carmen, at Covent Garden as Carmen, like Denise Graves, and had a camera following me around, including to the bathroom, I would probably have keeled over. You have to have such an energy and a will to have a career nowadays. So that if there's any way that my experiences can help a young person prepare them and make it easier, they have enough to deal with, and it might help. And I'd like to think so. So I'm happy to teach. I enjoy the young people. Oh, I can't tell you. There's just so much to still learn from them. I wish I could take some of the information I learned in the last 10 years and take it back to the stage, you know.
Do you advise them against what roles they should be doing now in their career?
Oh, that's a whole different subject. Now, when I say a different subject, I think that the way Mrs. Gurevich trained me was a very healthy one, because I sang lots of oratorio and lots of song literature as a young woman. She was appalled when I told her that I wanted to sing Aida for the first time, because she thought that vocally we could have waited a little bit longer, and we probably could have. But you also have to go and the opportunities come. There's that balance, you know, being ready when the door opens. But the preparation was there to vocally ease yourself into a more sophisticated repertoire. And to hear a young person of 17 singing Butterfly, or coming in at 19 or 20 saying they're going to sing Isolde, and to hear teachers actually give them repertoire that's destructive to them is one of my pet peeves. And I really... this is an area I can go off into a blue blitz about, because you have to nurture a voice. You must nurture not only the person's spirit and their minds, but you must actually nurture the physical part of growing into the right repertoire. Doesn't mean that they won't one day sing heavier repertoire, or even in a short period of time. But the beginnings, you have to learn different styles. People think that you just jump into singing Verdi. Well, you don't. We're not innately ready to sing Verdi and Wagner and these composers. And there's nothing wrong with learning how to sing a very, very, very fine Bach aria and a very fine Handel song or a Mozart song, Schubert songs. You learn so much old Italian songs, how to sing a line, how to learn the languages. I find the schools sorely lacking in languages. And of course, I'm a romance language major, so I'm probably on my high horse about that anyhow, and somebody can kick me off if they like. But you can't go out in this profession today and speak Italian sounding like you're coming from the Bronx. It's not accepted. There's too much competition out there. And if my husband dear makes one comment about my French, I'll never speak to him again. But he can't say that the German and Italian are bad. in the meantime, all of it takes time. It means constant work. It means constant preparation. It means a lot of money. We're talking about an expensive profession. It's not easy to be as prepared as one would like to be without proper financial backing. Therefore, if the young talent is coming through the school system, the schools must provide what's needed. That means languages, coaching, opportunities to sing as IU does in terms of performances. They're doing the repertoire that you can sing. One of my students just sang Despina in the last Così fan tutte. It was her first role, and she was as excited as she could be, and she has to grow from there. She's not a finished artist. She is a fabulous potential artist, and we all have to have that period of being a potential artist or being the potential star that you want to be. Not the star means so much. You want to be the potentially fine singer, period. Why did I come to teach? Because I've always felt that we not only learn throughout our lives from people, but hopefully we learn to give back, and that is a part of our profession, to give back.
You said you sang oratorio and you were doing art song.
Yes.
And you were doing concerts before you
lots
went
in, of recitals.
Yeah, recitals. How did you gradually work into what you would call the heavier repertoire, which would be the Verdi and Wagner arias and parts?
Oh, I just got old.
Sorry. First of all, I sang really in the beginning what doesn't sound like light repertoire, but at the Met I sang the bird voice in, well, there was the whole ring cycle, and I was one of the Walküres and one of the Norns and one and the bird voice, and I was one of the for the first couple of years, and Mr. Bing said, if you go and get your experience in Europe, when the time comes, I won't forget. And he didn't. In 1965 he called me back when Birgit Nielsen was sick to sing in a performance of Aida. But now I knew that if I failed in that performance, then it's not likely Rudolf Bing would have called me back yet again. So with the great luck of having sung some Aidas in Europe with Lovro von Matečić and Herbert von Karajan, I at least had that experience behind me in before coming back to the Met. I can't say that that's an ideal way of doing it, because when you say with von Matečić and von Karajan, you're talking about already very, very great established conductors. My career just went that way. But you can also sing in Bielefeld and Köln before you sing at the Met. You don't have to start at the Met. I started at the Met because of the Met auditions in 1958, which started sort of being recognized by those people early on, but that isn't the normal way. And there's some people you never hear of again. Some of the greatest winners over the Met period have not had careers, and then you've heard of other people that came via different routes. There is no one set way to get there.
Well, you mentioned something, though, a minute ago, and this leads to it, is if you get somebody into a voice part that they're not prepared for, does that foreshorten
you can
their
all,
career?
I think so. Certainly had Mrs. Gurevich not held me back and said, do those Handel Messiahs first and do those Johannes Passions first, and I had jumped too soon into the Aida, I might not have gotten past that. I might not have. Now, of course, someone else will come in and say, oh, I was singing Isolde when I was 12. Well, I'm not arguing with them. And I'm not telling them that they should have done it any other way. It's not my way.
That'll change the whole complexion of the love scene.
Well, let's not even talk about the complexion
yes.
of it. But when I was singing Elsa, I'll tell you, the complexion was really changed. But you know what I'm saying. Since there is no one way of or any right or wrong, you have to... the young talent has to be very aware of their own talent, of what they can do. They need to be guided, hopefully find the people that can guide them and nurture them properly, taking into consideration what their talent is. When I first heard Grace Bunbury, she had a whopping mezzo voice. I mean, she sounded like she'd been singing for 10 years. It was such an established, finished sound. So she sang heavier repertoire, and it didn't hurt her. I couldn't have gone that way. So it doesn't make it right or wrong that she did. On the contrary, she's still singing fabulously.
I think I heard her in her debut series of concerts in the late 50s when she first came through. But let's hear you again.
All right.
Let's hear something. We've heard Verdi. Now, what else do we have?
Well, we have something. Well, it's also Verdi, but we have O Patria Mia from Aida, which is probably one of the most demanding arias to sing technically as well as emotionally.
Well, since we've been talking about Aida, let's hear that.
All right.
We have just heard O Patria Mia from Aida, as sung by our guest today, Martina Arroyo. Now, that's a live performance, is it not?
Yes, it is.
And from where?
Teatro Colón in Buenos Aires. It was not professionally done. I think they're the mics from the theater, probably. So it doesn't sound nearly as well recorded, perhaps, as many other recordings. But I love live performances where you feel the people are involved, and when things can also go wrong, you know, if you're giving at that moment what you feel about the character, and you're emotionally involved. One of the things that I don't like about recorded performances is when you've got take number 23 for 10 bars and take number 77 two bars, is you miss the spiritual and emotional development a cut, even if you try to have it as a part of your presentation in all of the takes. They're not the same. The flow isn't the same. But in a live performance, what you're getting is how that person thinks through and feels through those words and that music at that moment, and you get the complete delivery.
Well, then you're getting the real love and passion of the aria as versus just some perfectly sung.
Yes, exactly. And I'm sorry to say sometimes I've heard recordings that were perfectly sung and you say, yes, but who's behind those words and behind who's the character, the living being in that body?
Well, that goes back to the importance of text and being able to flow then, does it not?
Well, yes. And by the way, I'm not saying this because I think that I was a great actress on stage. On the contrary, there will probably be those who will say I was the biggest bore in the world. Don't ever ask my mother. But the intention was always there. I've always liked having something, to being able to say it, to have the words have meaning.
If you had to do it over, build this career, would you do anything differently?
I'd lose about 25 pounds sooner.
That's talking about physical condition, is it not?
Yeah. Well, as I said, you know, I did go for the pasta. Or as my teacher said, she knew about pasta long before it became popular. I try probably to hone in a little bit more on my own discipline, meaning that I hear myself giving the advice to young people all the time about the importance of discipline. And when I stop and think about the truth about my personal life, I think, oh, I could have done a little bit more there. I could have been a little bit more serious there and perhaps taken the exercises and taken the advice of the doctors to take vacations rather than have 16 years without a vacation. And except that it was for me all so much fun that I didn't feel that I needed a vacation, to be honest. For me, it was a moment of an eye-opener was when I found myself waking up in my own apartment and not knowing which hotel room I was in because I didn't know where the bathroom was. You know, I traveled so much. Or waking up in one morning and finding out that I wasn't having the fun that I had had always. And that I used to wait. I couldn't wait as Butterfly to get out there. I wanted to get out and do my thing. And then it was like, well, you know, you can take your time. I'll come out whenever the music gets there. That's already a difference of attitude, and that might have happened, might never have happened if I had been a little bit more careful about vacationing and, as I said, and being a little bit more aware of the advice that I give now, which is why I hope the young people will take it.
there's got to be a number of rewards of walking out on that stage and pouring your heart out. But the rewards also come from the applause, from the recognition, I suppose. I mean,
oh, yes. It would be a lie to say that you first of all, you get an immediate success. I mean, if you have success and the people are applauding right there to say, yes, we like you, yes, we want to hear more from you, that's so immediate. I imagine great painters who never got that sort of recognition immediately must have not known how to keep going in a way. Except you also feel somewhere inside of you that you have a talent. And that you want to do this, you want to perform, you want to be out there. I'm not one of those who felt that if I didn't sing on stage, I couldn't do anything. Yes, I could have done a lot of things and have been a very happy person, because I do believe that this is no rehearsal. This is it. This is your life, and what you make of it, and what you do with how you think and how you prepare yourself for whatever it is, and your success in that area will come by your dedicating yourself and as much as you can to it. Had I not had the big success as an opera singer, I would have been a very, very happy school teacher. I can't say that I didn't love being the opera singer or the singer, period.
You mentioned earlier on that the voice is a God-given thing.
I think so.
But behind that, and we've talked a little bit about discipline and support and everything else, there must be a code of ethics or guiding principles that you use to monitor your personal and performing life. Is there anything there you can share?
Well, yes. I think that in the back of my mind, I always thought that the performance was the most important thing, not you or not me. That will not be agreed with by many artists who feel that their contribution to the performance is what makes the performance. For me, that performance of the Aida in Teatro Colón would never have been the level it was if I hadn't been inspired and had a real love for hearing my colleague Bergonzi sing the aria before me and had a closeness with Biserka to know that we, even though we were rivals on stage, were close friends and colleagues off stage. And my ethic being to love the work and my surroundings enough and always giving to them so that you got so much from them, but always being willing to give. I don't think you can close yourself off and think that you're the reason it happens. I think that you're a part of it and that you have to contribute to them and they contribute to you, and together you make the entire performance. And I think that's also an ethic, because you have to believe it and you have to work at that.
That's where your support group came into play, I would assume.
My colleagues, yes.
It's such a fascinating thing for me, who is not a performer in that same sense, to hear how much of yourself you lay out in front of people when the time of a performance comes.
Well, it has to be there for them, or else they don't feel it. But you also get so much.
If you were to have looked back at your career, is there anything that you wish you had sung that you didn't?
I wish I'd had 40 years as a 30-year-old so that I could have squeezed in Norma, which I was supposed to do, and a little bit of Isolde, which I loved doing but knew that I couldn't do. I did sing the Liebestod with an orchestra once, and I've also sung the Starke Scheide, the Götterdämmerung in Malaysian scene with an orchestra a few times, but I knew that I'm not a Brünnhilde, so I took advantage of the clout that I had and sang it with orchestra. But there were many roles. God, you don't even get me started on what I would love to have done. I would have loved to have done 50 more Giocondas and 50 more Cheniers, because in the first 10 you only begin to scratch the surface. You just begin to feel your way around. Then you start doing what you consider the real work. God, would I have loved to sung more Mahler eighths.
Can you just touch on the difference between scratching the surface and really getting into the heart of the part?
Well, now that's my personal definition, because I know that you have to know the part before you even get into your rehearsals, and you learn it even more as you're rehearsing and working it out with your colleagues and your stage director. But there is nothing like that evening that you step out there and the audience is there. And you try to make everything work. You know, you're getting into putting it out. Well, you don't really begin to have the courage to play with the other ideas and to play with the phrasing and to work with a nuance with a colleague, a change of a glance or a different turn until you've done it and you're secure enough. And you've done it often enough and you're secure enough to know that you'll be musically correct, you'll be where you're supposed to be in terms of the drama and of the staging and the drama, that you can then relax enough to try things, that you're relaxed enough to take from your colleague and react to a movement or the way that colleague is saying it differently than the night before because you're relaxed or a little bit more relaxed. That takes a few goings at the entire part, in my opinion. Other people will do it differently. I don't knock that they – you have to find your way. And it's only after the 10th Turandot that I really felt that I could – look at him differently and dare him differently because I knew that whatever I was doing was close enough to my interpretation that it wouldn't destroy it.
Well, I suppose you grow into the part and it's
going to
and it also is going to be different depending on who you're with.
Oh, enormous. I tell you, the difference between looking into a colleague that's involved with what you're saying and looking into a blank face who's sucking his teeth and thinking about his next meal. And you're getting back because you can only give when you get. I mean, it's act react. It's not. One doesn't work without the other. And when you, one of the reasons I really loved singing with Cheryl and Placido and Mignon and Grace because they were always. No matter when I looked at Mignon done on stage as Amneris, she was in the part. She was looking at someone else as Amneris. She didn't. She was never Mignon relaxed, picking her teeth. You know, it was she was always Amneris, whether she was glaring at me, even if the audience didn't see it, it didn't matter. Right. We saw it and we stayed in. And it made the time, I tell you, the performances go like boom because you're involved with these moments in these people's lives. If you're a butterfly and you're singing to Suzuki and telling her a story and she's listening to you, you want to tell her more. But if she's looking at you like her tabby hurts, you know, or when is this woman going to get to the high note so we can get on to my duet, you learn to block that out. You learn to just cut off and see the Suzuki reaction that you want or that you need. Of course it makes a difference.
Well, you're creating on the moment then in many cases, aren't you?
Yes, and it's your responsibility, therefore, to make sure you're there for your colleagues so that when they look at you, they get something back.
Martina, we've talked a lot about your operatic career, but now you're a distinguished professor of music at Indiana University. Can you tell us about your students, your studio, and what you want to accomplish? We've touched a bit, but let's elaborate.
I have a beautiful, airy studio full of light that I hope encourages the young people to come in and be bashed on their heads by their teacher. I'm probably not considered an easy teacher in terms of what I ask of my students, but I think that there's such a responsibility in this profession and they have so much to work up to and live up to that I'm pretty hard on them, but only because I'm not working with them if I don't feel that they're talented, from down to the last person. I just can't work with somebody if I don't believe in them. I teach a role class, a class where the students prepare, and they're young artists. They're not just students. They prepare an entire role. They translate the entire part, including the parts and the scenes in which they don't sing and the chorus. They learn. They do the background work. They study on the character and the whatever works the opera is based on. They discuss the character. They discuss the changes of the character, the development of the character throughout the opera. Then they must sing at the end of the semester the entire part. And sometimes they interchange, meaning they get friends to help them out. If someone has worked on Don Giovanni last year, they might come back and sing the Giovanni even though they're doing the Anna, you know, so that you get sometimes quartets and trios in the class. And I love that class. The kids keep me on my toes. It's amazing how much more they know than I do. And they keep me studying. I promise you that. But they're the future, and they need that type of work. This is what the school must do. This is what the school must give them, the preparation to go out and perform. The individual part of the teaching, we just keep working, hopefully allowing them to grow mentally as well as technically and physically. because it is our job to stimulate their minds to want to learn more, to hear more. I don't think the young people nowadays know as much as they need to know about the singers of the past and the immediate past. I'm not talking about necessarily Galikurchi. Some of them don't know who Renata Tibaldi is. They know the people that are recording right now. And we sing certain things a certain way now because of how it's been sung over the years. Doesn't make it right or wrong, but you should know that. You should know which is what you want to do and what you don't want to do and why it's done and why it wasn't done, but always why, not just that it's done. My students are, for the most part, wonderful open sponges that will take every ounce from you that you have to offer, and that's why they were there, so that's great. There are a few that are very, very exceptionally talented. Unfortunately, there's no guarantee as to which one is going to go ahead, the one that's exceptionally talented or the one who works slowly and shoots ahead in the end. Probably the biggest satisfaction is knowing that one or two make it. I'm still in contact with some other students from earlier on, that one is now singing in Regensburg as a regular. She just made her debut in Fledermaus. Another is singing in Boston in some oratorio societies. Mariana Cvetkova just made her debut at Scala as Ariadne, and Andrea Chenier, and in Dresden in Baluin Maschera. And she sang the Ariadne here at IU and was in the studio for several years. One young man who came from South Africa is now at Juilliard doing graduate work. And they stay in touch. I still get emails and calls from them letting me know what's going on, what's not going on, and finding out if their heart's broken because some guy left them or whatever the case. But they stay close to you. Because a teacher is a very funny thing. It's not just someone who teaches you about your voice. That person is a part of your life. And so I do hear about their private lives, and even though sometimes more than I should. You become a part of their lives, hopefully.
You have one large extended family.
Yes. That's what's so great.
And they all love you.
Not all of them, but I hope they at least like me a little.
All I can see is from you is a lot of love about what you do and what you've done and the people you've worked with. And what a great legacy.
Thank you.
You have sung a number of different styles. We talked about that at the beginning, the concert arias, the leader, Wagner, Verdi,
Yeah, well, the styles, but yes, would be like Baroque and classical, yes, romantic, yes.
How do you prepare for each one differently? Because it calls for a different type of vocal production, does it not?
No. Not for me. I don't think it calls for a different vocal production. I think all production has to be free, properly placed, properly supported. You know, we were talking about that support system. There's also the physical support system that's extremely important. But I think that you sing phrases different ways because one style might allow portamenti. Another style you would sing, you use embellishments of a different sort. Another style you might sing where the line is more important than the emotion or the character to take over as it does in Verismo. And sometimes something technically might not be as acceptable if you were singing Mozart, but it is as if you're singing Puccini. But I don't use a different voice or sing differently. I apply different tools to how I sing, whichever I'm singing. The idea of singing with less vibrato does not mean you learn how to sing without vibrato. You sing with we're getting into an awfully technical situation here, but when you learn how to develop your voice, you sing with the healthiest voice that you can. I never sang without a vibrato to make it have a lilies of the field, shepherds in the field, lack of vibrato sound that people like to say, oh, that's Baroque. No, I think that you apply certain things. There are moments, the colors of the words will make something sound vibrato-less. I don't see how you can then become what people think of as being Baroque as detached and away from the involvement of the words. Now, it doesn't mean that you sing it like Puccini. You sing it with a cleaner line, but the tool is the cleaner line. But you don't sing it differently. You don't take on a different sound because you're singing Bach. It's still the voice that you have well supported and better, as beautifully produced as possible.
Let me just ask you to really step back.
Yes.
It was a while ago. It was on an LP. It was a recording you made with Dorothy Maynard. I'd like to hear something from that. And what would that be?
A spiritual. You mean the spirituals.
Yes.
I've sung in church all of my life. And I love singing from the grassroots, my background. But I think that anybody to whom these words have any meaning, it becomes their grassroots and their background, too. The most beautiful spiritual I've ever heard was sung by a young boys' choir in Kiel, Germany, many years ago, when as a gift after a recital, they came up and sang the spiritual for me. And I cried. I couldn't stop crying. It was so heartfelt and so meaningful, and it was what the spiritual was about.
Can we hear one?
I'd love it.
What would that be?
How about, were you there when they crucified my Lord?
We have just heard Were You There, sung by our guest today, Martina Arroyo, as supported by the choirs of the Harlem School of the Arts and St. James Presbyterian Church in New York City, all led by the legendary Dorothy Maynard. Our guest today on Profiles has been Martina Arroyo, distinguished professor of music at Indiana University and one of the great singers of our time and one of the great people of our time. Martina, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Bob. It's been my pleasure.
The program you just heard was produced in the studios of WFIU in November of 2000. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash. For WFIU, thanks for listening.